Arlene Foster sat in front of me in December 2016 for an RHI television special. She gave her word that she had no idea why there were no delays in the cost controls for RHI. But the former DUP special advisor Timothy Kearns, in his written evidence to the RHI inquiry, has a completely different version of events. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, with us this morning. Set this out for us, Sam.
That's right, Stephen. In December 2016, as this scandal was spiralling out of control from the DUP's point of view, Jonathan Bell had gone to speak to you. He had done an interview. The party then decided that they would put Mrs. Foster up for an interview immediately after that. Those obviously ran back to back. And in that interview, as you said, she said that she had no idea about the reason for delays in cost controls in 2015. And obviously one of Mr. Bell's central allegations was that there were DUP special advisors working in the background to ensure that those cost controls did not come in when they should have come in. In Timothy Kearns' evidence, Timothy Kearns was the special advisor at that point to the minister, Jonathan Bell. He was really the right-hand man to the minister. He was meant to be trying to rein in the scheme at that point. He has given a very lengthy series of written statements to the RHI inquiry. They were published last night, and he will give oral evidence today. And in those, he says that the day before the Nolan interview was broadcast, I telephoned Mr. Bullock, that's one of Mrs. Foster's special advisors, to inform him that I didn't think the party's communication strategy regarding Jonathan Bell was sound. I had been listening to the Nolan radio show. This was the first contact I had with Mr. Bullock since May 2015. He put my call on speakerphone, and Mrs. Foster and Mr. Timothy Johnston, another of Mrs. Foster's special advisors, identified they were in the room. I suggested that Jonathan's character needed to be put under the microscope, and they agreed. I confirmed I would tell my story if needs be. And then, coming on to the crucial aspect of this, he says that discussion then turned to more general RHI matters. I started to recount the June 2015 meeting and the fact that Mr. Bell's behaviour had not been dealt with, and that Mr. Johnston had directed I speak to Andrew Crawford. Mr. Johnston clearly became uncomfortable, and the conversation was quickly
directed
brought to an end.
He spoke to Andrew Crawford about what?
Well, we know from elsewhere in his evidence that he has made very clear that it was Dr. Crawford who told him to keep the scheme open, uncapped for as long as possible, to delay cost controls until the latest possible date that the civil service would accept. He is saying here that this was something which was discussed. Now, he doesn't go into great detail as to how detailed he was with Mrs. Foster, but he then goes on to say he was asked by the inquiry whether Mrs. Foster, when she subsequently spoke to the Assembly, had really been entirely candid in passing on what she knew. Mr. Kearns says, in pretty crucial evidence, I think, he says, I do not believe that Mrs. Foster, either in her Nolan interview or in her statement, that is, to the Assembly, fully expressed the view I had stated to her on the speakerphone call that Mr. Johnston had given at least initial direction in this matter. Now, he will be asked about this in much more detail at the RHI inquiry either today or tomorrow, but essentially what that does is put on a collision course Mr. Kearns, who at the height of the scandal was very supportive, it would seem, of Mrs. Foster, somebody who, to the best of my knowledge, remains a DUP member in good standing, with the leader of the party, who said pretty categorically, and there wasn't much room for manoeuvre in her answer, she said she had no idea.
Well,
what happened there.
Let's go back to December 2016. This is when I went up to interview Arlene Foster. She knew by this stage that I had interviewed Jonathan Bell. That's why she was giving this interview. And let's listen carefully to what she told me in December 2016.
There seems to have been delay after delay. If you think about it, they want the scheme changed in September. They then want the scheme changed in October. They then want the scheme changed in November.
No, the submission that was signed by Jonathan in September stated that the scheme was to close in November.
No, there was a period of October where they wanted it changed
submission,
1st of October.
No, the submission that he signed off in September said November.
1st of October was also a point that they aimed for, First
yes,
Minister.
What he signed off on the 4th of September was that the scheme would close in November.
What I'm asking you is, do you know why there were these delays then?
I have no idea.
You haven't asked?
No, that's a matter for John. And why would I ask? I was Finance Minister at the time.
Why would you ask?
Yeah.
You're the first Minister of our country This is a scheme which has cost hundreds of
millions. Yes, a scheme which Jonathan kept open for a period of weeks.
And you still haven't asked what the delay is
about? No, because Jonathan hasn't spoken to me for a long period of time.
I'm talking about you asking on behalf of the public.
Yes, well, perhaps I'm sure he'll tell you why he delayed the scheme and left it open for a period of time. It would be very interesting to hear, because I am bemused as to why he would leave it open for such a period of time.
So let me get this right. We are hearing now of people who have been putting boilers into sheds and blasting heat into the sky. We know that these delays were a factor. And as our First Minister, you still haven't asked what the delays were about. You still haven't briefed yourself.
Because Jonathan signed off on a submission on the 4th of September.
Do you not want to know?
Well, I'm sure you've asked him the reason why he has left the scheme open for that period of time. I'd be very interested to hear why he has said that, because, of course, there was no influence from the former First Minister. There was no influence from me as Finance Minister. How could I have an influence, because I was at the same level as Jonathan? He took the decision to leave it open for that period of time.
So quite a few emphatic no's in there, Sam, that she had no idea, again, no idea, Arlene Foster's words. And yet we have, so far in the RHI inquiry, Dr. Andrew McCormick, the Permanent Secretary, giving evidence a few days ago, saying that he was surprised by that answer. And now we have another contribution, this time from a DUP special advisor, Timothy Kearns, saying that Arlene Foster had not fully expressed the views that he had stated to her. That was the day before she gave that interview, right?
That's right. And I think what we're seeing is that this part of that interview, this part of Arlene Foster's story, which has been a very consistent story on this point, she has said that she as you said there, she was not aware of what is alleged to have been going on in 2015, and that really the first she learned about it was much later. What Dr. McCormick, as you said there, told the inquiry last week was that he had been discussing this matter, that is the allegation, his belief, his understanding that Arlene Foster's special advisor was the figure in the background trying to delay cost controls. He said that he was discussing that with Mrs. Foster's key advisors, the people who were preparing her for her interview with you on the evening that it was broadcast. He was speaking to them over several days about this very factor. They knew it was a critical weakness in the story, the belief by senior civil servants that there was a senior DUP figure who had been involved in this. And he told the inquiry, Dr. McCormick told the inquiry, he could not prove what Mrs. Foster had been told. So he says, I know that I told her advisors, but I can't prove that she was told that. But he said that he would expect that a minister in that situation facing a difficult interview would be given the full picture. What we now have from Mr. Kearns is a completely different avenue, whereby it is said that Mrs. Foster personally, not via a conduit, not via an advisor, she was told in a conference call where there were several people in the room. Now, we have to see what those other people say in their statements.
She was told that Timothy Johnson was Timothy Johnson's a special advisor, and very close to powerful people in the DUP. He's currently the chief executive of the DUP. She was told what by Timothy Johnson, about Timothy Johnson?
From what Mr. Kearns says, he told her that Mr. Johnston had asked him to liaise with Andrew Crawford. He doesn't go into a great deal of detail about that, but what he does do is that in his answer as to being asked whether Mrs. Foster fully conveyed what she knew at that point, he says she didn't. So whatever it was that he told her specifically about that, we'll probably learn a bit more about this in oral evidence, he does not believe that she told the public everything that she knew about this. And clearly from her answer, she was saying very clearly she knew nothing about this. You know, she had no idea. There is no possible way that she could have known, she was saying, because she was finance minister at this point.
So I can simplify this, Sam. Both Arlene Foster and Timothy Kearns' version of events both can't be true. One's not true.
That's right. And I think that is where the significance of a public inquiry comes into play. This is evidence which is being taken on oath. There are very serious repercussions if the truth is not told, and therefore there is a very clear compulsion on people to tell the truth. if we had not had a public inquiry, and you will remember that Sinn Féin obviously for a long time did not want the public inquiry, for a long time the DUP didn't want the public inquiry, we would have been in a position where one person said one thing, another person said another thing, and really it would be difficult to prove who was telling the truth. It may still be difficult to prove who's telling the truth here, depending on what is said at the inquiry, but there is a much more rigorous structure here, which impels or at least very, very firmly encourages people to tell exactly what happened and when it happened.
Do you think, let's come outside the inquiry for a moment or two and talk about the public appetite for this. Obviously, this story was running at its peak every single day in the media cycle, and you know the public were very much obsessed with this story. We all wanted to know the twists and the turns and what had actually happened. Do you think the public still care as much, Sam, about this? And you said political careers could be affected by this. Do you really think so?
Well, I think that certainly the febrile atmosphere which there was in December and January of 2016 and 2017, I don't think we have got that any longer. That was a particular moment in time. That was a crisis. We're not in that sort of fast-moving environment anymore. But I think that what we are in is in a much more dangerous process, perhaps, for anybody who did act improperly here. Because while it's very embarrassing and it's very politically difficult to be facing allegations on the Nolan Show or in the newsletter, the Belfast Telegraph or wherever, it doesn't have anything like the weight attached to it in law and in consequence for senior politicians of a public inquiry. And therefore, while this is a slower process and at points it certainly has got very technical, it is, I'm sure, lost a lot of the public at various twists and turns in this process. On these central issues of who knew what when and who was upfront with the public and who told exactly what they knew and who acted when they did know something was amiss to try to put it right, those, I think, are very loaded questions for any politician if they're not answered in the correct way. And I think there is a second very significant aspect of Mr. Kern's evidence where he alleges that Dr. Crawford, Mrs. Foster's advisor, told him that both Dr. Crawford and Mrs. Foster were aware of allegations from a whistleblower that the RHI scheme was open to abuse. That is something which Mrs. Foster has really, again, very consistently said that she was never told about this, and if she had been told about it, she would have acted very decisively. Now, Dr. Crawford, it has to be said, and it's very important to say this, was, according to Mr. Kearns, passing on to him that he wanted something done about this. So it wasn't that he was saying this is unimportant or that he was complicit in this. He's saying that he was trying to get something done about it, but he was aware of this. Mr. Curran says, and again, there are elements of the official version of events from the DUP leadership, which I think will come under intense scrutiny. But as with all of the inquiry, we're hearing little bits of this at a time. We'll get Mrs. Foster's view on this very soon, and Dr. Crawford will be up later this week. So we will have a much clearer picture, I think, in a couple of weeks' time.
The story we were talking about Timothy Kearns talking about Timothy Johnson, you've tweeted today that this could make things potentially difficult for Arlene Foster. Extremely difficult were your words. Is that because this is DUP on DUP?
Well, I think there are several aspects of this which make it much more difficult to dismiss Timothy Kearns than it is to dismiss Jonathan Bell. Jonathan Bell was never a terribly popular figure within the DUP. He was certainly very senior in that he was a minister at one point, but he was somebody who really was seen to exist on the patronage largely of Peter Robinson. And once that went, he was always going to be in a somewhat vulnerable position. Timothy Kearns is a much more low-profile figure within the DUP, but he is somebody who, as I understand it, remained a DUP member. He is somebody who is withering in his evidence about Jonathan Bell, so it would be difficult for the DUP leadership to simply say that this is some sort of hit job on Arlene Foster or anything of that nature. And also, he is somebody who has very deep roots in the DUP, and I think that while we will see this teased out in a lot of detail, we'll see him put under pressure, we'll see him asked to justify some of the things which he did, some of the things which he says. He is somebody who I think potentially is very difficult for Arlene Foster if he is alleging that at a point where he was supporting her, where he was trying to help her, and where he was judged significant enough that, according to his evidence, he was put onto the speakerphone in Stormont Castle with Arlene Foster at the height of this crisis. There were a lot of people who, I'm sure, were not getting put straight through to the First Minister at that point. That's how significant Mr. Kearns is to all of this.
Well, surely a phone record would show Sam who was on that conference call. It wouldn't show obviously what was said within it, but it would show who was on it, and then obviously you would follow what was said within it, and there were four people on that conference call, correct? Richard Bullock, Timothy Johnson. This is according to Timothy Kearns. Richard Bullock, who was again a very senior special advisor within the DUP. He's no longer with the DUP. Any meetings that, for example, I would have had with Peter Robinson when he was First Minister, Richard Bullock and Timothy Johnson were both by Peter Robinson's side. They were senior strategists within the party. There is no doubt about that whatsoever. So on this conference call, let's go over this again, get it into the public's heads, what Timothy Kearns is saying. He is saying that a day before Arlene Foster told the public she knew nothing about why the cost controls had been delayed, Timothy Kearns is claiming that there was a conference call in which it was Arlene Foster, Richard Bullock, Timothy Johnston and himself, correct?
That's right.
And he is saying that in that conference call that he told Arlene Foster what?
He's saying that he told Arlene Foster that Timothy Johnston had asked him in the summer of 2015, in June 2015, as the scheme was spiralling out of control, but it wasn't fully known, it would seem, from Mr. Kearns' evidence that to Mr. Johnston just how bad things were. He was told by Mr. Johnston, he says, to liaise with Andrew Crawford, who was Mrs. Foster's advisor. And we know then from elsewhere in his evidence that he says that Dr. Crawford was the person who was then instructing him on that authority, as he saw it from the very top of the DUP, to delay cost controls as long as possible. And we know as well from elsewhere in Mr. Kearns' evidence that he believes that what Mrs. Foster said to you, what she said to the Assembly, was not giving the full picture of everything that he had told her in that phone call about that period.
And Sam, to be clear, is Timothy Kearns then saying that it was Timothy Johnston who advised to delay the cost controls or Andrew Crawford? Which?
He is saying both at various points. I think he says that it was Mr. Johnston who initiated the process, and it was Mr. Johnston who had the seniority to be able to say to him that this is what you're going to do. You're going to deal with Dr. Crawford, who has been in the department. And that at that point, he says that Mr. Johnston was saying that really cost controls would not be coming in. Now, he then clarifies that somewhat in later statements, and he says that while he stands over that evidence, he does not believe that at that point in early June 2015 that Mr. Johnston fully comprehended just how bad things were. What we do know, though, from his evidence, again, this is what Mr. Kearns says, is that throughout the summer of 2015, he was in regular contact with Dr. Crawford, and that on several occasions he discussed with Mr. Johnston how that process, if you like, that he says he initiated was going, and he told him about some of the issues with the scheme. So while he says that Mr. Johnston didn't know at the start of this process just how bad things were, he says that he was kept in the loop both by himself personally and he believed also by Dr. Crawford.
Well, Timothy Kearns will be in front of the RHI Inquiry today. If you want to watch that, rhiinquiry.org, where you will get the rest of the evidence that has been given so far. Important to remember, and let's be fair to Arlene Foster, that this is one day of evidence, and it is for the inquiry to determine who is telling the truth. But what you are seeing here unfold in front of you is different people within the DUP having fundamentally different versions of events. Both Timothy Kearns and Arlene Foster's versions both cannot be true. So one's false and one's true. And that's where we're at. Then, Sam, I look at the front page of the newsletter today. The headline, Foster didn't tell the full RHI story, SPAD. That's what we've just discussed. Obviously, Arlene Foster would deny that. And then you have another headline, Drunk Bell Slept in New York Bar. Obviously, Mr. Bell would deny this, but what's this story about?
Actually, just for clarity, I think Mr. Bell wasn't really asked about this in his evidence, so we haven't really got his side of the story here. It may be that, I mean, he's finished his evidence to the inquiry, and this is really a bit of a tangential issue to the inquiry's terms of reference, but it may be that we get his view at some point. But it's a really pretty remarkable story. We're told by Mr. Kearns, who was accompanying Mr. Bell on what was a trade mission to America, that the minister went out for dinner with Mr. Kearns and a couple of his civil servants. And he says that he got so wildly drunk, really, that he fell asleep. He got very drunk, he says, over dinner. They then went to a New York bar. He says that while he was there, the minister fell asleep while drinking. He then was wakened because they were being threatened with eviction because he was sleeping. He then ordered another drink. And then he fell asleep again, we're told. He was then formally ejected from the premises. We're told that he sang loudly as he was being put out and had to be helped back to his hotel room. Now, that's a very colourful version and a very detailed version of an account which Dr. McCormick, who's the most senior civil servant, or was the most senior civil servant at that point in Mr. Bell's department, gave last week to the inquiry. He said, in much more carefully phrased language, which you might expect from a senior civil servant, that he understood that Mr. Bell had a very late night and that as a consequence the following morning he looked very tired and he was not able to fully discharge his duties as minister. So really a fairly lurid picture of someone who you will recall, obviously, and your listeners will recall, presented himself very much in his interview with you and in the other situations as an evangelical Christian, as somebody who was pretty soberly minded, and somebody who was a serious politician, and somebody who at various points spoke out against the dangers of alcohol, and obviously the party of which he was a member was founded by somebody who was pretty vehemently anti-alcohol and spoke about the devil's buttermilk and all sorts of things. So really a very troubling picture for some traditional members of the DUP if they believe that this is what happened, not maybe massively relevant to the inquiry's terms of reference, but adds to the picture of what was going on during this period, where it's clear that there was a very dysfunctional relationship between Mr. Bell and his special advisor, and also this was in the period where they were trying to rein in the scheme, where the scheme was finally about to be closed. They were out of the country for a few days in this trade mission, but really it certainly wasn't the only factor in Mr. Bell's thinking, according to the evidence of his special advisor.
Sam, you've also reported that it is claimed Jonathan Bell started compiling a dossier about other DUP members. What's this about?
Again, this is something which is maybe not massively relevant to the terms of the RHI inquiry, but I suppose it's part of the wider picture as to what was going on and what the relationship was between senior DUP figures at this point. It seems that it was pretty bad in terms of the relationship between Mr. Bell and not just Arlene Foster, but some other senior party figures. And that in Mr. Kern's evidence, once Peter Robinson, who he saw as really Mr. Bell's protector, if you like, the person who put him in post and who kept him in post despite other people not being happy with him. Once he had gone, he really said that he became paranoid and he became quite vulnerable within the party. And in early 2016, he says that on a daily basis, Mr. Bell would recount stories about party members and their indiscretions. He says, quite intriguingly, and he doesn't say who he thinks was behind this, but he says that it was clear to him that someone was feeding Jonathan this gossip. Now, we know from Mr. Bell's evidence last week that he claims that rather than him feeding gossip to Mr. Kearns and talking about these things, that he says it was Mr. Kearns who talked to him quite inappropriately about the alleged sexual misbehaviour of two DUP ministers. Yeah. But whatever the truth about who initiated this, both men say that they were discussing this and that really Mr. Bell became increasingly erratic in Mr. Kearns' evidence. He was explosive at points, he says. He had quite a violent temper. And that he said that he was compiling this dossier. He was going to submit it to the party officers. He said at one point it was under lock and key with his solicitor. Mr. Kern says he never actually got to see the dossier, but it seems that Mr. Bell was certainly deeply unhappy in this period where RHI was being closed. And I think where this does touch on the terms of the RHI inquiry is that we know from Mr. Bell's interview with you and from his other evidence that he really feels that people were out to frame him in that period. He feels that Arlene Foster was saying one thing orally to him and another thing in writing, and he was very suspicious. And this maybe adds to the picture, if it's accurate, of what was in Mr. Bell's thinking at this point, and perhaps the prism through which he viewed what was going on with RHI.
Well, obviously, I had been meeting Jonathan Bell prior to the interview, Sam, back and forward. And Jonathan Bell did bring to me an allegation about the sex life of a DUP member at that time, and I wasn't interested. But he was pushing it to me at the time.
Well, he also subsequently, of course, raised this in the Assembly. Again, he didn't mention names, but he had said that really people in DUP, and I think he referred to DUP MLAs, and Mr. Kearns actually relies on that in his evidence, saying that Mr. Bell told the Assembly it was DUP MLAs who were coming to him with this information, and Mr. Kearns says that shows that it couldn't have been him because he wasn't an MLA. But Mr. Bell clearly was deeply agitated, it would seem, at that point on Mr. Kearns' evidence. And on both of their evidence, there was this discussion going on about the private lives of senior party colleagues. Now, on one level, that's neither here nor there, some people might think. On another level, for two government senior government figures, at a point where there are deep difficulties within government, not just in this scheme, but in other aspects of departmental policy, some people might wonder about what was going on and what the level of focus that Mr. Bell was giving to his work as minister and what level he was giving to compiling this dossier of whatever length that may have been.
I'm just sitting reflecting on the last 25 minutes here of our conversation. Like, what political party would want to be seen with their clothes off like this? This is the DUP being stripped bare, all of the conversations, and if any political party had this, they wouldn't want it, stripped of all of their clothes in this, that everything's being laid out in the public, Sam. What on earth will that traditional grassroots DUP member be thinking, DUP voter be thinking, as they hear all of this?
I think there'll be a lot of dismay. I think among the old traditional Free Presbyterian wing of the DUP, the section of the party in which it built its success for decades, and while it has diminished within the party, it's still a very significant section of the party. I think some of those people will just be really struggling to comprehend what they're hearing. I think there might be an element of the pigs in Animal Farm, perhaps, thinking, what on earth have we gotten ourselves into here? These people were deeply uncomfortable in some cases about all sorts of things which the DUP did over recent years, from going into government with Sinn Féin to doing various deals, all sorts of things. But I think there was always in the mind of that section of the DUP a moral righteousness to what the DUP was doing. They saw it perhaps not as an extension of a church, but they certainly saw it as more than a political party, saw it as something which did not engage in what they would have seen as sinful behaviour, if you like. Of course, we have only got one aspect of this story. It will be for the inquiry to decide if it does indeed make any finding in this, whether this is accurate or not, and we'll have to hear what Mr. Bell says. But the very idea that a senior DUP advisor is alleging that this is what was going on within the party, I think that is something which will make perhaps some DUP members a bit nostalgic for the era of Ian Paisley, when there were lots of difficulties within the DUP, but this was something which they perhaps wouldn't have envisaged coming up under his leadership.
Sam McBride, thank you as always, sir. That's the newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride.